Or are there men in black? Very provocative subject. A lot of opinions for and against in part of the subject. And some people have had some very nasty experiences with the gentleman in black. And we look forward very much to hearing what Archdeacon tonight has to say about them. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present Mr. Norman Oliver.
Thank you very much, Arnold. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now, you know, I seem to be up here so often these days in one capacity or another that I really couldn't blame anyone for thinking I was doing rather too much of the talking. Especially since, as you'll see from your cards, that I appear to be hogging two meetings completely. So, firstly, I'd like to explain how this came about. Now, I put myself down to speak for Cosmos on March the 21st, having just completed the Cosmos program, when John Terry Baker sent his Bufora program through to me, saying that he'd left the February date open for a talk by me. And as I had to get the details off to the printer straight away, I had the alternative either of leaving tonight's date blank or of giving two talks, one to Cosmos and one to Bufora. Well, I chose the latter course, which explains why you have to sit and suffer both in February and in March. You know, I've given a variety of talks on UFOs to a variety of associations and societies. From church, from youth clubs, from young conservative associations, to astronomical associations, via such noble institutions as the Totteridge Women's Institute, where being the only male present, I was somewhat unnerved and certainly unvoiced by being expected to sing Jerusalem before I began. Through then to the South of the Thames Jewish Society, where before the light dawned, I was somewhat bemused at first by everybody wishing each other a happy new year when it was only just October. However, it's one thing to give a talk to people, most of whom haven't the slightest knowledge of the subject, and quite another to speak to those who are already well-versed in saucer law. And even if they don't know all the answers, at least they know all the awkward questions. First of all, let me make it quite clear that whilst I pose the title of my talk, the question as to whether there are men in black, I do not, to my knowledge, number any of the gentry amongst my acquaintances. Neither am I one myself, and I sincerely hope that none have managed to creep in here tonight. In fact, quite frankly, I do not know the answer to my own question. So before someone asks me then why the devil I'm speaking about them, I'll tell you what I propose to do. This is to give you quite a few facts on various alleged men in black cases from different parts of the world, to discuss various lines of thought on the subject, and then leave you to accept or reject any of these as you see fit. Now, at this stage, it occurs to me that whilst most of you here know something about men in black activities, there may well be others who are comparatively new to the subject and are wondering what the heck that bloke up there is blathering about. We came here hoping to hear something about flying saucers. Well, very briefly, men in black came into prominence quite a few years ago now when a chap named Al Bender was persuaded to give up his UFO researching activities following visits by three of these gentry. Since then, quite a few UFO researchers, people who've had UFO sightings and contactees, are alleged to have been so approached in one way or another and subsequently silenced by intimidation of some description. I believe in some cases this may well have occurred. I'm certainly not saying it hasn't. But one thing I would ask you to bear in mind, and that is that most people love a mystery. I do myself. And if I may be forgiven the paraphrase, may have made a mystery out of a molehill. I said in some cases. However, to come to examples, there is really so much material that it's a hard job to know where to begin. But I think that some of the reports and articles in Saucer News from the States, articles by John Peel, Gray Barker and James Mosley, are as good a place as any. Now, in the editorial of Thought and News of autumn 1967, James Mosley wrote, "Information reaching us during the past few months from several reliable sources indicates that leading researchers, as well as ordinary sources cited throughout the country of course being the USA, are being subjected to an unbelievably complex and extensive series of frightening events. Amongst them, attempted as well as successful hush-ups by mysterious strangers usually dressed in dark clothing, weird or threatening phone calls and letters, and so on. The appearance of cars with meaningless license plates, or no plates at all, which have followed certain UFO investigators in the course of their work, and other events which are so utterly fantastic that we hesitate to put them into print. Please don't think that we've lost our equilibrium or are merely trying to jazz up the UFO investigation. We are merely reporting the evidence which we've uncovered. It is difficult to pinpoint just when and where these events begin. Our first attempt to bring the truth to our readers regarding this new phase in the mystery was on a summary issue where we reported that the U.S. Air Force admits to having checked out a number of cases in which mysterious imposters bearing impressive but completely phony official credentials have visited and frightened saucer fighters in various parts of the United States. This following report, which was from John Keel, was later substantiated by an official Air Force letter dated March 1, 1967. And his editorial says that this letter, intended for distribution to all commands, is signed by an Assistant Deputy Chief of Staff of the Air Force. I can't help feeling that an Assistant Deputy Chief of Staff is someone rather low down and not high up itself. Mosley's editorial continues, "At a recent UFO convention in New York, several delegates claimed to have been watched and followed while walking on the lower level of the Hotel Commodore by individuals who looked and acted like official military or civilian investigators, but who, as we later learned by checking with the manager, had no connection with the hotel. These men were apparently working out at a room near the hotel's coffee shop, to which there is access from a low-level hall and from the nearby Grand Central Station. There's even reason to suppose that they had wiretapping equipment set up temporarily in the room, though by the time anyone thought to check this out, it was too late, the convention was over, and the men, whoever they were, had departed." Well, so much for the excerpt from James Mosley's editorial. In the same issue of Thought and News, there are a variety of Men in Black reports quoted, and again, I'm not saying I believe or I disbelieve any particular one, though I will say that I don't think it is by any means inconceivable that one or two of them have been jazzed up a bit. Anyway, here are some of them, a year still being 1967. On August the 4th, a black Cadillac made a deliberate attempt to run over a UFO witness on the main street of a Long Island town. Again on Long Island, two men in Air Force uniforms harassed UFO witnesses. One of these men identified himself as a Lieutenant Frank Davis and threatened two different people with a revolver, warning them to watch out who you talk to. Colonel John Dalton interviewed at least three Long Island residents and asked them to fill out complicated forms which contained involved questions about the witness's personal history. Through officials on Long Island, John Keel had a check run on both these men. The Air Force denied that it knew anything about either one, or that men with those names were assigned anywhere on the island. Lieutenant Frank Davis later turned up in a postman's uniform and was followed by Keel. Davis and another man were engaged in taking photographs of the homes of UFO sightings. While involved in this investigation, Keel had two encounters with a large black Cadillac in an isolated section of Long Island. In one of these encounters, the Cadillac, which contained two dark-skinned men, was parked and laying in wait on a deserted road. In the other incident, Keel did a turnabout and followed the Cadillac for several miles. Also reported the following incident alleged to have happened to a Mr. Robert Easley of Defiance, Ohio. Now, Mr. Robert Easley would seem to be a sort of researcher of some repute, holding positions of importance in several UFO organizations. including that, although higher director of the Interplanetary News Service, and he was apparently an assistant investigator to the late Professor Maynick. In the small hours of July the 11th, Mr. Easley was awakened by a phone call from a lady who told him that she and seven others were observing two bright, fast-moving UFOs. After she hung up, he immediately got dressed and went to the sea. While checking out this report, he noticed that he was being followed by a man in a black sedan with no license plate. The driver, who was a complete stranger to Easley, was dressed in black shoes, black dress trousers, and a dark blue pullover shirt. He missed out on that one. On July the 15th, he was again followed home by the same man in the same car that he was driving his girlfriend home. When he pulled into her driveway, the unknown car sped off. Later that evening, as the two sat talking on the front porch, the car came down the road and stopped right in front of the house as soon as the topic of UFOs entered the conversation. Easley could feel the man staring at them. When they got off the subject, the car left, but when they returned to it an hour later, the same car came back again. It was as if the mysterious driver could hear what they were saying or could read their minds. On July the 17th, Mr. Easley was checking out another rather routine report, and the man reappeared and followed him to and from the scene of the sighting, dressed in apparently the same clothes as before. Between the 11th and the 17th of July, Easley received a total of 12 strange phone calls. In each case, the only sound on the other end of the line was a strange beeping noise. Each call lasted for about 15 seconds, followed by complete silence. The beep sounded far away and as if coming from a machine, possibly a tape recorder. No explanation could be offered by the telephone operator. Easley tends to connect these unusual events with plans that he had during that period to check out a possible flying saucer landing site in southern Ohio. After the area was finally checked in early August and found to have no importance after all, the succession of persecutions ceased. Even though it sounds something like a plot from the TV series The Invaders, Easley believes that the aliens, whoever they are, apparently knew about his plans to explore the site and rested easy after nothing was found there. Mr. Easley now echoes the warning given out many years ago by Albert K. Bender, one of the first alleged to be silenced by the notorious Three Men in Black. Bender said, as many will remember, that extreme caution should be exercised by all UFO investigators. Now, there are many more examples, I should say alleged examples, of Men in Black activity in this and in other editions of Saucer News. And I would stress that all I am doing is presenting them to you, not vouching for their truth. Now, however, before I turn from the American scene, an article written by John Keel again in 1967 is worth quoting from, as it is written from the silencing viewpoint, if I may call it that. Personally, I do not entirely agree with him, particularly so far as my own experience in this country goes, but more of that later. This is what Keel had to say, and I will quote it. It is, as I know, already been printed in one of the issues of the Bevora Journal elsewhere, but I think it's quite worthwhile to read that. Keel wrote, "Already thousands of people in the United States know the full secret, believe it or not, and thousands more will have the answer before this year ends." I believe the year was 1967. "These people comprise a select group which we now call silent contactees, and have been playing a small but important role in the numerous flats for the past 3 years. In my travels throughout the country in the last year, I've uncovered and interviewed dozens of these silent contactees. They all have the same story to tell, and more important, most of them have been given identical artifacts as proof of their experience. The silent contactees differ from the over-publicized contactees of the past in several important ways. First of all, they are afraid to speak up and reveal what they know. They find themselves in the midst of a complex conspiracy which poses personal threats to them, and they have involuntarily enlisted to participate in a series of experiments and adventures which go far beyond anything ever dreamed up by science fiction writers. Extensive contacts have actually been going on since 1939, but many have been handled in such a manner that the contactee did not actually realize what was happening to him, and frequently rejected the whole situation as some kind of hoax, or, in some cases, as an hallucination or a ghost experience. In many cases, once the contactee's role in the phenomenon was finished, they were somehow brainwashed, and conscious memory of their experiences was wiped away. I've learned of other cases in which the silent contactees either went insane or committed suicide. A number of very well-known UFO researchers have been silent contactees for years and have cautiously sprinkled genuine clues in their books and articles, but have never dared to reveal the whole story. Other prominent ufologists have been contacted briefly and given specific information to be deliberately passed on to their readers. Ironically, real truth is so bizarre, sensible researchers usually reject it outright until they themselves have had first-hand experience. Many of them find it impossible to cope with emotionally, and they quietly abandon UFO research in the interest of self-preservation. Nearly all the speculations and conclusions of the last two decades are totally false. The celebrated scientific method cannot, in fact, be successfully applied to this situation. Astronomers and scientists are the people least equipped to understand the phenomenon, thanks to their rigid discipline and preconceived notions of the universe. Metaphysicians, on the other hand, are too gullible and too quick to apply any pseudo-scientific explanation. There is no simple answer to the mystery. All of the current theories, ranging from extraterrestrial to fourth dimensional, cannot actually be applied. Once the researcher has learned to revise his approach to the subject and discover the keys to look for in the new cases, he can uncover the secrets in a matter of weeks. Many have already done so, and they are keeping their mouths shut. The secret has been under our noses all along. Even before this article is printed, thousands more will learn the real truth behind the flying saucer. Like the others, they will all keep quiet. Not even their neighbors will know. The UFO truth is something like psychiatry. The psychiatrist cannot tell you what is wrong, he can only guide you to learning the truth about yourself. So it is with UFO. It takes personal experience to convince you of the truth. You have been told the truth many times in books and publications, but you have rejected it. This elusive truth cannot be summed up in a few words or a few pages so that it will seem more credible. Some contactees have tried. Unfortunately, very few people are strong enough or emotionally stable enough to cope with the whole secret. And the average UFO researcher does not fully realize the great personal risks involved until they have enmeshed themselves in the situation, and then it is too late. That's the end of the quote from John Keel. Well now, I think from the fact that I formed Cosmos in order to uncover contact cases, and to investigate and put into practice all possible methods of possible communication with spacemen or space entities, says for itself that I don't entirely go along with this. You see, from what John Keel writes, it follows to me that he therefore ought to know the whole secret himself, and therefore be one of these presumed increasing few. But surely, if, as he says, we've been told the truth many times, our minds, or most of our minds at any rate, ought by now to be capable of accepting it without going round the bend. Because according to Mr. Keel, we must have frequently read it. Now, I don't pretend to know all the answers, answers myself. That's what I want to find out. But surely the answers must be along some, or some combination of these possibilities. Sources could be visitants from interplanetary, interstellar, or intergalactic space whose occupants may be either friendly, hostile, or intent on exploitation or colonization. They may or may not have connections with the spiritualistic, occult, or religious fields also. Craft may be interdimensional, with beings from other planes of existence, possibly even coexistent with ourselves. Space crew found some bases under the Earth, or for that matter, bases on the Earth, the occupants being Earth bases we're unaware of, or from other planets or systems with bases here. They could be time-traveling from Earth or elsewhere. They might own us, own this planet, and for all we know, Titania ownership could be changing hands at this moment. It is possible we may be being invaded by some type or types of entity that can change their forms at will, use whatever occasion it might be that requires suiting. Or again, Earth may be about to explode, or be engulfed in the sun turning nova, and they're here to take off some of the population now being chosen, or as some believe, to herald the dawn of a new age on Earth. They may be partly or entirely connected with what we might loosely term the occult, and not physical entities at all. Now, there are many more possibilities I could quote. I'll finish the list with one that some people have come up with, and that is that they come from the devil. Now, I'm perfectly capable, as I'm sure many others, of accepting any of the foregoing possibilities, and plenty more without going round the bend. Particularly since, according to John Keel, we've already repeatedly been told the answer, therefore it should lie somewhere amongst those I've already mentioned. Now, they come from the devil. These words, you know, remind me of a complete fallacy in Al Bender's book about the three men. One of them told him quite categorically, there is no life after death. Well, they're alleged to have told him that. Now, just think about that for a moment. Because if there is a life after death, it must always be a possibility, as indeed many people believe, that those who have died will find a means to tell us so. Now, the only way we could possibly know that there was no life after death would be for someone who had died to tell us. Should there be no afterlife, which they obviously couldn't do. It's a paradox. Certainly, one may choose to believe or not in an afterlife as one pleases. But a categorical statement that there is no afterlife is impossible to substantiate, and so whatever one believes, there must always remain the possibility. Well, having got slightly adrift from Men in Black, let me pause here and turn to cases in Great Britain. Now, on December the 5th of the year before last, the BBC programme Today included a three-minute interview with a Mr. Brian Leafley Andrew, who'd opened a UFO information centre in Coventry, and he decided to close it down following some rather unusual happenings. Andrew immediately had it that this was a Man in Black case. This was in fact referred to in an earlier edition of the Cosmos Journal. However, I wrote to Mr. Andrew and asked him if this was actually so. This was his reply, and I quote, he said, my original intention was to collect information from the public who had seen or had experience with UFOs or similar objects. The results were remarkable. I had about 12 genuine reports phoned or sent by letters to me from local people. I also had some non-genuine idiots phone me in the shape of Batman and someone who called himself a Martian. But these are no consequence. The phone call I was concerned about was on the second or third day of the centre being opened. It was a man who phoned, and he spoke in perfect English, in fact, too perfect. He used no slang or everyday expression. He asked, almost insisted, that I told him all the information collected by me during the time that the centre had been open. He also asked if a woman had been in touch with me to tell of aliens she had seen working on a UFO or spacecraft in Coventry. He would not let me question him on this, but I can only presume he meant a craft which had landed and was being repaired. He goes on, another impression I formed whilst talking to this man was that he had seen this woman watching him working on the craft and wanted to know if the fact had come to the attention of myself or any other authority. Caller's last words were, I will contact you in 2 days. Please don't publish anything I have told you. He didn't contact me again. And Leafley Andrew goes on, an incident occurred with lights of varying intensity on about the third or fourth week of the centre being open. I was in the house of someone who had seen UFOs on at least 3 occasions. We had press cuttings out and were discussing scout craft and motherships, and the possibility of the latest object he'd seen being part of what someone else had seen and photographed. The main source of electricity is 240 volts and is fairly constant to about 5 and no more than 10 volts up or down. The dimming that occurred was in the order of 40 volts up or down. This occurred for the second half of the 1.5 hours I was in the house. The third incident occurred when I was repairing my car at the rear of my mother's home. I was in fact underneath the car, which was raised off the ground by two ramps. I was in the open and able to see the garage next to that of my father. And as I was getting out, I saw a man with an orange face. The face was glowing and perhaps more red than orange, and the head about one-third larger than normal. It had eyes, nose and mouth, but I cannot tell whether any ears were attached to it. Nothing was said to me, neither did I say anything to the face, which as I watched it began to melt. The orange-red appearance left it, and it became smaller and changed to that of an old man. The conversion from the red scene to normal taking about half a minute. Well, in answer to various questions I put to him, it was established that only the one phone call lasting 3 to 5 minutes was received by Mr. Andrew, who stated that the caller asked him if anyone from Cosmos contact UK or Bufora had been in touch with him. Now, I strongly suspect here, if he'd been writing to Bufora or Contact UK, the order of those three would have been reversed, but never mind. The call was made to his home, and the caller did not, as I had first thought, request Mr. Andrew to abandon his usual activity. In answer to a question about possible electrical faults when the dimming incident occurred, his reply was, "This is possible, but for lights on a normally stable circuit to vary about 40 volts up and down 5 or 6 times is a bit much." So nothing there that one could really call pressure from Men in Black, despite the fact that it was alleged to be so in the first instance. Now, we now come to another rumoured MIB case in another part of England, which was referred to not all that while back in a British UFO journal. Now, I haven't obtained the permission of the person concerned to talk about this case, but I think you'll agree it really is worth mentioning, so I'll be very highly original and call him Mr. X. It was alleged that Mr. X had abandoned his saucer activities after Men in Black activity, and rumour also had it that he'd been scared into doing so by a man who'd transfigured himself in the presence of Mr. X and his wife, some sources suggesting that the man himself was an alien. However, I went to see Mr. X myself and found that he had not abandoned his UFO activities at all. Although, in a twisted sort of way, there was a basis of truth in the MIB suggestion. Although his actual experience would appear on the surface to bear very little relation to UFOs, I think you'll find it well worth repeating. So here it is. Now, the man who apparently was capable of transfiguring himself, I shall call Bill. He does happen to be his name, actually. He's in his 60s, he's a regular churchgoer, and was actively interested in UFOs as well as psychic matter. Now, this man had formed a local UFO group, and here's the MIB connection, had disbanded it after two or three visits from Men in Black types who had threatened him, once when he was actually in church, although it's not exactly clear what he was in fact threatened with. However, our Mr. X came to hear of Bill through Fred, and he and his wife called on him several times. On the last occasion, which was in September 1968, Mr. X asked Bill about his reputed ability to transfigure himself, and Bill told him yes, it did happen, but he couldn't control it. It sometimes happened when his mind was tired, and suddenly he appeared to the people as a different person, he himself being fairly short and thin. Well, on this last occasion, Mr. X and his wife had stayed until about 1 or 2 in the morning before they departed. And as they were going down the path, Mr. X found that all his movements were slowing up, and it was as much as he could do to move. He looked back, and the figure at the door was that of a man who looked completely different and had an utterly different build, very portly, not thin at all. Mrs. X became very frightened and told her husband to hurry to the car, which was parked a few doors out from the house, it was in such a position that they would have to drive past the house again before they reached the main road. Well, Miss Gratz just about made it to the car, although his movements were getting slower and slower all the time. He just couldn't do anything about it. And inside the car, it was icy cold, although it was a pretty warm night for the time of year. He got the car going, still in slow motion, and as they gradually passed the gate, he saw the figure walking down the path to the gate. And as he, or it, walked, they could see it was surrounded by a blue aura. Anyway, as the car gradually moved out of the area, normal movement came back to Mr. X, so he still felt cold and mentally and physically unwell. This feeling suddenly left after about an hour. The following day, they told friends about the occurrence, and a few days later, they had a phone call from Bill, who said he'd been told he'd had a transformation when they left, but he'd been unaware of it at the time. And he said he'd like to come over and see them, which, after some demur, they finally agreed to his doing. When he came, he told them that all he remembered was walking down the path to wave them goodbye. He was absolutely himself unaware of any transformation. The only tentative explanation of his transfigurations he could give was that he believed that in a former existence he'd been a monk, and that when his mind reached a certain degree of emptiness or tiredness, his former personality took him over. He added, too, that at times he visited a certain spot in the grounds of Yorkshire Abbey, I've been there myself actually, where he felt a very special sense of relief and elation, although at another spot, about a quarter of a mile away, he felt exactly the opposite. Well, altogether, quite an unusual story, I'm sure you'll agree, and I think one well worth repeating. Well, now, some of you will know, I'm sure, that I had a great deal to do with the investigations into the Scoriton mystery, in which the late Ernest Arthur Bryant was the central figure as the alleged contactee. Well, I'm not going into the pros and cons of that case now, except on 2 points. Firstly, some months ago, to my astonishment, I found a reference in one of the American magazines to Bryant having been visited by men in black. Well, I'm not saying he wasn't, but I will say, and without fear of contradiction, that I've spent more time on Bryant's claims than anyone else. I visited him on numerous occasions, I had dozens of letters from him, and altogether about 10 or 12 hours in freight recording. And absolutely nowhere is there any indication whatsoever that he suffered any form of attention from men in black. I would very much like to know where that magazine obtained his information. Trouble is, I read it in passing, didn't mark it at the time. Perhaps he had something like 30 different American exchange magazines, I hadn't been able to locate it again. The second point I would like to make about Scoriton is this. I regard it as an inherently possible story. It could have happened. Unfortunately, I now regard it as extremely unlikely to have actually done so. The reason I refer to it again now is that while I don't regard them as classical men in black types, I now believe there were in fact 3 involved in cooking up the story that Bryant executed. I shan't say any more on this here now, since this is the men in black talk, not the hoaxes on March the 21st, when in other cases, amongst other cases, I shall be expounding more on the development of in the Scoriton affair. Now, to make a personal point, I can only speak here for 2 UFO organizations, but to my knowledge, no one in any executive position in these organizations has ever been threatened in any way because they've been delving too deeply into the UFO enigma. On the other hand, I often wonder, you know, should I at any time decide that UFOs were taking up too much of my time and I dropped active interest in the subject, that there are a whole crop of rumors would start up about my having been silenced. I rather think they would, you know. As far as actually being approached is concerned, I can only repeat what I wrote in Cosmos Journal number 2, which was, should communications of any type be received from men in black, Cosmos guarantees that such communications will be publicized in future editions of the journal, whether or not they are of a threatening nature, and no matter what form they take, subject only to the Northern obscenity. I should just add to that, though, that as I also wrote, would-be hoaxes need not bother, should they do so, well, they will be exposed to the pages of this journal when found out, but please note the word is when and not if. In other words, what I'm saying is, as far as this country is concerned, and I stress this country, that I've come across very little basis or evidence of men in black activity. Certainly not at, both at the executive level. I'm not saying there is none, only just in the one case I referred to earlier have I found any indication that there might be. Now, before I switch back to a final look at the magazine, I'm sure you'll forgive me for referring once again, as I did last week, to the most unfortunate recent death of Dr. Lindner, the well-known Australian ufologist who at the time of his death was on a world tour on behalf of his employer, and was at the same time grasping the opportunity to visit various UFO personalities and societies in the various countries he passed through. Lionel Dear invited me to meet him when Dr. Lindner visited London for a couple of days last summer, and I was therefore extremely upset to hear that only about 10 days later he'd been killed by a train at Frankfurt Station in Germany, the day following going to see Carl Dieter Wiesbaden, who publishes the German paper Ufo Nachrichten. Now, less than a week after his death, I heard it implied from several different people that this was a Men in Black case. He'd been pushed, and so on. Well, what in fact actually happened, as you can read in Space Link, is that as he was getting his last pieces of luggage on the train, it was flagged away, and he fell under the train as it started to move, being dragged along by it as it left the station. It was a very sad and unfortunate accident, but it had nothing to do with Men in Black, and it's worthwhile bearing in mind how quickly, in some people's minds, it became so connected. To return again for a moment to the source of news. The idea was put forward in a recent issue that UFO personalities were being duplicated, or at least impersonated, by men in black types on a number of occasions. Various noted researchers had apparently been seen and spoken to in different places at the same time. This line of thought, you know, is an intriguing one, whether or not one believes the report. As one of the things John Keel has alleged, is that some contactees and witnesses of saucer landings have been threatened with substitution should they not remain silent. Mind you, if we take this line of thought too seriously, it does become paradoxically a sort of cartoonish dream of the how are you, I think I know who you are, who am I variety, and also rather science fictionist. But oddly enough, I do know of a case in this country where substitution has been alleged, although not in an MIB context, this particular case supposedly being with the consent of the person concerned. Before I finally leave our old friend Saucer News, incidentally, you may be interested to know that allegedly photos were taken of Men in Black, and they appear in a copy of Saucer News that I have here. For what it's worth, that is a photograph. There's also a photograph of a car on the front page of it. Well, obviously they could have been quite deliberately posed, although I would hesitate to say definitely that they were true or false. But it is, I think, worthwhile pointing out that the pictures of the car do not go down as far as the number plate. One thing quite a few people, particularly those who are interested in flying saucers, seem to suffer from are odd phone calls. I referred to Mr. Easley and his alleged boots earlier on. One can also find that there's no one at the other end of the line, and find one's conversation interrupted by peculiar noises and so on. So far, this hasn't troubled me over much. Please, no hoax calls, I wish I hadn't said that. Actually, and this has nothing to do with flying saucers, or at least if it has, it's working in a pretty roundabout manner. But actually, nearly all the wrong numbers who do not up, and there have been plenty of them at all hours, they want the nearest doctor. Which puzzled us quite a bit until I found out that our doctor's health service registration number, which was all on all his patients' medical cards, just happened to be the same as our phone number, which explained quite a lot. The only odd call I can really remember personally was one evening when I answered the phone, and all I seemed I could hear at the other end was the usual heavy breathing. So after I repeated our number, and said hello a few times, I decided I'd do something a bit more drastic. So I took a deep breath, put my mouth close to the mouthpiece, with the top of the voice, shouted, "Oi!" I then put the phone down with considerable satisfaction. A few minutes later, however, the phone rang again. And I had to put Kate, an irate brother-in-law, was complaining I nearly busted his eardrum. So I'm not really sure whether to recommend this method or not. However, again, to get back to Men in Black, it's obviously really up to the individual to make up his or her own mind on the evidence available as to whether they do exist. For my part, and if you think, incidentally, that I seem to treat things a little lightly, this is because I believe that a sense of humour is very necessary in this interest of ours. Without it, one can start to take oneself far too seriously and lose one's perspective. This, however, is something totally different from taking the subject seriously, which I hope I do. For my part, therefore, and I would stress that this is only my opinion, it seems to me that whilst there could be a lot of wildly exaggerated and made-up stories concerning the MID activities, at bottom, I think there are some grounds, at any rate, to indicate that some of these gentry do exist. Now if, and again I say if, one accepts their existence, the question obviously becomes, who are they? And again, if one assumes their purpose is to dissuade further thought or research, why are they doing so? There is a possibility they're agents of various governments. They could be Earthmen controlled by alien beings. They could be aliens themselves. They could be agents of this world's vested interests, our old friends and known to Zurich, if you like. They could be genuine investigators whose actions have been misinterpreted by some of the people on whom they've called. They could be employed even by saucer societies and journals to whip up interest when it might seem to be flagging, another sort of vested interest, so to speak. As I said earlier, everyone likes a mystery. So I'm sure you'll agree that as far as societies in this country are concerned, there's not one society in Britain that could afford to employ full-time staff, let alone half a dozen men in black. Well, what would be their object? Well, we have the old chestnut, suppose the idea of their being government agents is concerned, that sorcery information is being suppressed because it could cause panic and mass hysteria. Yet if so, this method would seem more likely to create panic than to stop it. It might be that aliens are deliberately trying either to suppress information getting out about themselves or just to confuse us. It could be, as many people think, that we are the centre of a conflict between good and evil forces, the men in black obviously representing the evil or satanic forces. It's possible, if the answer is that their agents are vested interests, that they're being used to combat the likelihood of any great degree of contact between ourselves and benevolently inclined space people, which might lead to a complete social, technological, and, if you like, moral revolution, and that this would completely shatter their position of power. As I say, it's a valid point of view. So I'm sure there must be plenty of more possibilities that I haven't mentioned. I'm sure you can doubtless think of quite a few more yourself. But I'm going to wind up the moment by leaving you with two further thoughts. First one being that all this country's, and I'm sure all other countries too, all this country's saucer societies suffer because of the various shades of opinion that there are saucer-wise, which is often very difficult, if it's not impossible, to reconcile. Anyway, one question I'll leave you to think about is the rather enigmatic one. Could it be that in fact some of the men in black are men in white? The second thought goes back to the adjective black again. Now, it's surprising, you know, how frequently witches, witchcraft, and black magic crop up in connection with UFO investigations. I know of three or four such cases over the last few months. So, could our men in black have any connection with witchcraft? Well, I think I've covered a fair amount of ground, possibly too much. I'll just finish with a request. Should any of you be approached at any time by any of these gentry and feel they are the genuine article, so to speak, please don't keep it to yourselves. Tell me about it as well. Thank you.